So, Shabbat Shalom, everybody, and it's good to have this opportunity still to get together on Shabbat and talk about let iron sharpen iron, talk about His Word, things like that. What I wanted to do today is take a little bit different tack. As most of you know, a lot of times on Erev Shabbat, I'll go through the Torah portion in whole and try to go through it. Because this one has to do with, well, a number of things. I guess if you were to step back and say, at least in the beginning of the portion, the primary stuff has to do with rebellion, has to do with Korah, has to do with jealousy, has to do with power and avarice and the lust for power, a lot of those kind of things. And when you really see how it all boils down, obviously it doesn't work out well for Korah, doesn't work out too well for those that followed after him. There are a whole lot of lessons in here, but the one I want to focus on again is one that I think is so key for us today, and that is as we come out of something. Now, if you think about it in terms of parallel cycles, we're a little bit behind time-wise where these folks are with Moshe. We don't have a Moshe. We don't have that kind of a leader today. We are arguably still in bondage and still looking to come out. It's a whole different part of the cycle. But the things that have to do with our understanding of leadership in that process, I think that has a whole lot of bearing. The things that have to do with our understanding of what it was that these folks did wrong, why so many of them died, well, that certainly is key. What I've referred to over the last few weeks as the whining, that's still a major part of the human condition. So all of that has a lot of bearing, things for us to understand. But where I want to focus, at least in the beginning, as we talk about Korah, or Korach in the Hebrew, is this idea of leadership and power versus influence. I did talk about that a lot last night. I think one of the things that gets us in trouble is we still make some of the very same mistakes that Korah did, because we don't understand the nature, in a lot of respects, of leadership. We're still looking for the wrong kind of kings. Look at what's going on in the United States and in the Western world and in Russia with Putin. Hey, they got their Imperial Putin. We got the Imperial Obama, both of which seem to have a secret police, CIA, KGB, NKDV background. Amazing how so many of these things kind of continue to be hallmarks of the human condition. People that gravitate towards position of power, if you will, like Korah, they suffer from that same lust for power. Now, I'm gonna mention one other thing. Speaking of influence and power and the lust for power and how it manifests itself nowadays, I was reminded this morning, probably came from the source that hopefully at least is giving me some clues as to what I ought to be talking about. Chairman Mao, remember the famous line that he used? He had a number of them, but one of them was, all political power or all power flows from the barrel of a gun. Maybe that helps to explain, as things begin to go down the porcelain pony swirling away, why so many in positions of power in both the United States and in Russia, and of course in Great Britain before that, and Australia, are looking to disarm anybody and everybody they can. They don't want to share power. That lust for power kind of has a consistent pattern of the way it develops all over the world. All right, let's talk about one other thing to set all this up. I'm going to get to the Torah portion in a second, but I was reminded that the Haftorah portion that goes with this is from 1 Samuel, and it starts in chapter basically 11 to 12, which has to do with the rise of Saul as king, and he goes out and he fights the Ammonites. This, though, is after we've heard the people of Israel demanding, give us a king, give us a king. We want a king like all the other nations. That's when I've talked about democracy in the past, I'll sometimes point to this as probably the second of the major obvious votes by acclamation that was wrong. First one we've talked about last week, the 10-2, the spies lost. doesn't look like when people outvote God that it works well for them. Same thing happens here this week with rebellions. If we can't get it done one way, we'll try it another way, evidently. And we get to Saul, and by acclamation, they say, give us a king like all the other kings. Well, Samuel says, hey, here's what's going to happen. This is the kind of king you're going to get. If you ask for this, be careful what you ask for. Sometimes Abba will answer your prayers, and you might not like it, because he's already warned you about some of this. What I want to do is introduce all of where we're headed today with the introduction to the Haftorah portion, which I think probably starts at Samuel 1, but Samuel 8 here, 1 Samuel chapter 8, is the place where we see Israel demanding a king. And let me read just a little bit of this. I'm going to excerpt it. I'm going to paraphrase it, as I often do, from the New King James. See if you can't spot some parallels. It came to pass. Here we got the prophet Samuel. He's old. He made his sons judges over Israel. Gives the names. Firstborn was Yoel. Second, Abiyah. They were judges in Beersheba. But, maybe this sounds familiar. Sons didn't walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes. They perverted justice. They'd be great candidates for a high position in government today. Maybe Supreme Court. His sons, they irritated folks. So all the leaders of Israel gathered together. They came to Samuel at Ramah and said, hey, you're old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. So now, here's our excuse. Give us a king to judge us like all the other nations. This displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So he went and he prayed to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who told him in turn, hey, listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So according to all the words which they've done since the day I brought them up out of Egypt. Hey, there you go. Even to this day, which they have forsaken me, served other gods. Here they are, doing the same thing to you. So therefore, heed their voice. But do this first. Solemnly forewarn them. Show them the behavior of the king who will rule over them. Samuel told the words of Yahuwah to all the people, and he said, here's the nature of this king when he comes to reign over you. He's going to take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. Okay. Take a look at the world today. Do we have in conscription? Do we have people being taken away from their families and sent to run before the king's chariots? Well, they may be a little different in the way they're powered, but yeah. He will appoint captains over thousands and over fifties, set some of them to plow his ground and reap his harvest, make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. Check. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And now we see other things as well. He'll take your best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves. Those will go to his servants. He'll take a tenth of your grain. Well, I wish I could say check there. He's taking a heck of a lot more than a tenth nowadays, almost everywhere in the world, but especially in the United States. And he'll take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys. Put all of them to work. Take a tenth of your sheep. You will be his servants. Check, check, check. You'll cry out in that day because of this king that you've chosen for yourselves, and Yahuwah will not hear you in that day. Do I dare say that just maybe there'll be a check coming there too? So the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, no, we will have a king over us. Now, I'm going to hearken back to a time where, again, different parts of the cycle. Remember, if you see a repeating cycle, there's an up part and a down part. Pendulum swings one way, swings the other. Take a look back at a couple of hundred years ago in U.S. history. We'll come back and touch on this once or twice, to the nature of the revolt against an evil king then, King George III, who wasn't hearkening to Elohim. The indictment that was laid out and signed unanimously, this Declaration of Independence thing, talked about that and said, hey, this king is not properly obeying Yah, the king of the universe, divine providence, the creator. He isn't doing the things that he ought to be doing. So, therefore, we've tried everything else. Now we're going to list this indictment. Here are all the bad things he's done. The remedy is we, in these states, ought to be free and independent states. There was another phrase that you would have heard back then, particularly from the Christians and from the pulpits of the day. And while we might take issue with some of their understandings, and that's a good thing, in a lot of respects, I'd have to admit that some of those churches, even though they were worshiping on the wrong day and so forth, probably had a lot more on the ball than we do nowadays. At least they knew not to be incorporating before Caesar and similar kinds of things. Well, they said the following oftentimes. No king, no king, no king, but King Jesus. You've probably heard the phrase. They knew that Samuel had warned them, and they basically were saying, we don't want a king anymore. Let's try something different. Okay, back to the story here. Samuel heard the words of the people. He repeated them in the hearing of Yahuwah. So, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said to Samuel, heed their voice, make them a king. And you know the rest of the story, right? They got Saul. When Samuel gives his farewell address, which is where the second part of the Haftorah portion today goes on, this is at the coronation of Saul. He warns them again, kind of tells them in hindsight, hey, look, I have indeed heeded your voice, you folks, and all that you've said to me, I made a king, or, you know, there's a king been made over you. Now, here's that king walking before you. I am old and gray. Look, my sons are with you. I've walked before you from childhood to this day. Kind of like Moshe, he says, have I taken any bribes? Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? If you can show it to me, I'll restore it to you. And they said, nope, you haven't done any of that kind of stuff. So he said, well then, Yahuwah is a witness against you this day that you've not found anything in my hand. And they said, yep, we acknowledge that. And it is he who raised up Moshe and Aaron, brought your fathers out of Egypt. So therefore, stand still so I can reason with you. And basically what he says at some length is, you may perceive that your wickedness is great eventually. You have done evil in the sight of Yahuwah in asking a king for yourselves. People said to Samuel, pray for your servants to Yahuwah, your God, that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins the evil of asking for a king for ourselves. Okay, let's pause there. Is that what's happening here? I noticed a couple of interesting things. I'm going to talk about, as always, some of the things in the news. Draw some parallels. I want people to ask some difficult questions as we think about where we are and, of course, what we ought to do. I contend that the answer's already been given to us. It's come out of her, my people. Don't participate in the sins so that you don't partake of the plagues. Touch not the unclean thing. Separate yourself. We see all kinds of prophetic elements in Scripture beginning to come together. People will say, hey, we've inherited lies from our fathers, things wherein there's no profit. What do you do when you realize that? Well, you don't outvote the king that the masses have picked. That wouldn't have worked with Saul. It's not working today. What can you do? Especially if you realize that Mao had a certain amount of correctness, at least so far as the princes of this world are concerned. All power flows from the barrel of a gun. Let me throw out one more question up front. It occurs to me, as I'm getting to lay out all of this stuff, we're going to talk about the difference between power and influence. What can powerless people have if they've been disarmed and they have no other options? Can't outvote the king, especially when most people are ignorant and darn well proud of it, and have been dumbed down, like Hitler warned, hey, you know, you give me control of education, I'll take your kids, I'll have control of everything within a generation. And he was right, and it's still true. And all of his propagandists and all of the nasty stuff with the Dr. Mengele's of the world and, you know, our Germans are better than their Germans, as Werner von Braun famously said, none of that evil knowledge has been, that Gnosticism has been allowed to pass away. It's now being employed in fashions that would have made Adolf very, very jealous when it comes to propaganda and Madison Avenue and computer control and Big Brother's watching, you name it. Let's go back, okay? We've laid out enough stuff here and talk about Korah. The dispute between Korah and Moshe and the difference in their leadership styles and, well, several of the things that will, again, it seems like we're trying to tie a whole bunch of stuff together, and I apologize for that, but sometimes when we get to the point where we are today, we really want to kind of say, okay, what do we need to do? Well, it's necessary to stop and try that. One more quote. This one comes from one of my favorite authors when I was a kid growing up. Still somebody that I admire, although I probably have some philosophical differences with him as well. That's Robert A. Heinlein. So the apologist to Heinlein, he said something like this once in a pretty famous quote. Humanity divides itself into two camps. Those who have, I'm going to put it this way, a lust for power over others. Those who desire to rule over others. Those who desire to be, in the words of the Torah here, above others. And those who have no such desire. Those who want to rule, to have power, to lust for power. And those who have no such desire. You know where Korah fits, right? Korah, son of Itzar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and with along with Dathan and Abiram, basically grandsons or great-grandsons of Reuben. They took guys, they rose up in the face of Moshe, they assembled themselves, and they said three famous things. Turns out, one of the three is a big whopping lie. Two of the three are correct. That's pretty close to the 80-20 rule. You take, first truth, you take too much upon you, seeing all of the congregation are set apart, kadosh, holy. Kodeshim, because it's plural here. All of them, they're all set apart. Well, that's true. And here's the second truth. Yahuwah is among them, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Well, of course he is. You can see the Shekinah glory, the cloud by day, pillar of fire by night, the Mishkan, they've built that. It's right smack in the middle of them. So that's true too. But here comes the whopper. So therefore, you lift yourselves up above the assembly of Yahuwah. They ask it as a question, but it's made as a statement. Why? Why do you do this? Why do you lift yourselves up? If there's a single metaphor that kind of really helps to outline the difference in leadership style or in lust for power that's going on here, it's that one. Korah sees Moses and Aaron as above everybody else. Whether it's true or not, that's the way he sees it, and that's what he lusts for. That's what he wants to be. By the way, I'm going to suggest to you that's exactly the same pattern of human behavior that attracts people, especially in democracies and in other kinds of things where they think, hey, I can lust for power too, to those positions of influence. It's part of the reason why, maybe a democracy, I like to refer to them as demonocracy, is arguably one of the very worst forms of government. I've heard political scientists and others make a good case for monarchy. Now, I had trouble believing this, but I find the logic at least interesting. Let me just lay it out for you. A hereditary monarch sees the people as his property. By the way, so does Washington, D.C., so does London, so does Brussels, you name it. This property. But the difference is the hereditary monarch oftentimes wants to pass this along to his children. He has an interest, in other words, in taking care of his property. It's good old-fashioned property interest. Whereas in a democracy, you don't have quite the same thing. You got to keep the people, at least if you truly have a democracy, up until you can subvert it and get your propaganda stuff in place, you don't have to worry about it anymore. And if you can control the election process, you don't even have to worry about that. You just got to make sure they don't revolt outright, or even if they want to, that they're disarmed, right? Somewhere along the line, A monarchy does have one kind of inherent advantage over some other forms of government. That is that if the ruler sees these people as property, then he takes care of them, just like he does his horses and his stash of gold and his harem and all of his other stuff that's mine, 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 mine. I'm above them. Isn't that wonderful? But on the other hand, if you see them instead, and I like this term because it's so evilly descriptive, as human resources, well, you depreciate them. That's what a good businessman does. Well, you write them off. And when they've been depreciated to zero, you can dispose of them, just like any other resource, mechanical or anything else. It's what they're for. Use them up, throw them away. There's a big difference there in attitude. But in any case, the thing that remains the same is this idea of being above them. That seems to be really the essence of this understanding, of this difference between Moses and Korah. Now, what I want to do is talk about the other aspect of the same coin, at least for a minute. Now, this is one of those teachings that you'll see in a couple places. I thought it was interesting. I'm looking at a piece that was written by Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, and it's entitled, On Leadership, Servant Leadership. And he puts it this way. In Judaism, to lead is to serve. Now, some of you that come from a Christian background will know, hey, isn't that the essence of the teaching of Yeshua? That's one of the few things that the church got right. You want to learn to be a leader, he says? Learn to serve. Learn to wash their feet. He did that in the famous demonstration. Going to wash the disciples' feet. He among you who would be first, I'll learn to be last, and so forth. It's the exact opposite of the way that the world tends to think about it. Again, Korah wants power for himself. The protesters too, those 250 that joined him, they were probably disingenuous. But what they did say was two-thirds true. And as I've already mentioned, the problem was with their last remark. Why do you set yourself above the congregation of Elohim? This was a fundamental mistake, is the way this this author puts it. Not a small mistake. Moses represented, insofar as the history of the world is concerned, a whole new kind of leadership. And this is what Korah and those who followed after him didn't understand. And still, many of us don't understand it. I will contend that if you look at the leadership in the world today, it's exactly the opposite. And I mean exactly the opposite of what, you know, Obama, the last few challengers, all of them. Putin, the kings of Europe, now followed by the demagogues of Europe, and all the others. It's a whole different understanding from what they had. You go back in U.S. history, a lot of would argue that, hey, George Washington, at least, kind of exemplified the opposite, servant leadership. He could have been made king, and he refused it. At the time, I remember a quote from King George III, who said, this got to be the greatest walking fellow on the face of the earth to turn down that kind of power. For crying out loud, who would do that? Answer, he did. Whether we have some philosophical differences with the way he spoke about his religion, I don't think he was exactly the same kind of Mason that we have today. But regardless of that, the point is, he did seem to understand this leadership. He went back on his farm. He didn't want to be a hereditary king. He turned down the chance to be a ruler of the kind that none of the rulers I can see in the world today would have ever turned down. And to that extent, ain't nothing new under the sun either. I like this line. I quoted it last night. The most famous buildings in the ancient world, says Jonathan Sachs, were the Mesopotamian ziggurats and the Egyptian pyramids. These weren't just plain old buildings. They were statements in stone of a hierarchical social order. Now think about that. That's a great way to put it. They were wide at the bottom, narrow at the top. They were statements in stone of the social order. At the top, of course, was the king or the pharaoh, or now we got the emperor or the president or the Rothschilds or whoever you want to put up there. Doesn't matter. Beneath was the series of elites. This is the very nature of the feudal system that we can see reinstituted all around the world, too, where you have the king who owns all the property by whatever title, and then he has his dukes, his duchesses, his earls, all of these other elites, land barons, they take up and down the chain a percentage. And at the very bottom, take your pick of how you want to describe them, the laboring masses, the proletariat, the peons, the serfs, the disposable human resources. This was considered to be the only way to organize society. And you know what? We're going right back to it. It's the only way that's being considered today, too. And it was true 1,000 years before Moshe. It's still true thousands of years after. And perhaps Plato's Republic and some of those things that show up just around the time of Yeshua give us an indication of the mindset that was still there. Some are born to rule, others to be ruled over. Now, he says this, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs. I'm going to take some issue with this terminology. I think there's more to to this distinction that we're talking about than merely saying Judaism as a religion or Jews as a people. Well, when a rabbi says Jews, he intends it to mean Kol Israel, all of Israel, not just those maybe. Sometimes it's not the same, and that's true with a lot of words. Not just those who are born into it. By the way, the Catholic Church says the same thing. Their replacement theology says the same thing. We're Israel, you're not. So here's the line, and I'm going to rephrase it. Judaism, he says, is a protest against this kind of hierarchy. Now, the statement's true, but I think you could go one step broader and say the Torah. The whole Torah is a protest against that hierarchy. There is one at the top, if you will. That's our Creator, King, Messiah, husband. Pick any terminology you want, any of the metaphors that show up in Scripture. Master, all of these are ways that we can picture Him, Father. And the key thing about all of them is that there's one of Him, period. Only one of Him. He's Echad, and there's many of us. Whatever way you want to describe Him, there's one of Him, there's many of us. And we want to be in His kingdom. We want to be brides. We want to be servants of the Most High. We want to be subjects in His land, His Olam Haba. Any way you slice it, there's still one of Him. He's the boss. We aren't. But, and here's the important but, every human being, and not just the king, the earthly king, or the Pharaoh, or the emperor, or the president, is still created, as Torah tells us, in the image and in the likeness of Elohim. However you want to interpret that, the statement is clear. So, and here's the thing that I think is probably one of the most important statements that we're going to hear today, out of a summary of the Torah. Therefore, no one is entitled to rule over any other without their assent. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, said Joshua, we will serve Elohim. Choose this day whom you will serve. Deuteronomy 30. You've heard me, if you've listened more than once, quote verses like this many, many times. I have laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. So choose life. Choose, choose, choose. Choose life. Probably the single best two-word summary of how you can resolve any questions about the Torah that you ever would have. Looks like a contradiction? Choose life. Understand, Elohim is the creator of life. All of the things that He lays out for us, all of His instruction basically boils down to, hey, here's how you do it. But the important thing is do it. Choose life. Let's go back to that line again. No one is entitled to rule over any other person without their assent. Why did I start with Samuel 8? Give us king like all the other nations. What you have there is assent by acclamation. With Korah, you got a bunch of people throwing in their lots with him. And you got a bunch of people whining later. You've killed the people of... Plagues come. The pattern is still clear. You got a choice here, folks. It's why we're told today, come out of her. What was it that they told the people before the time that Korah was getting ready to get whacked? If the Lord does a new thing and the ground opens up her mouth and swallows them up and they go down alive into Sheol, you'll understand these men have despised Yahuwah, provoked Yahuwah. Move away from him. Hey, you see that guy standing over there, all those people standing with him? Separate yourselves a little bit. Step back. You may want to give him some room. Watch what's going to happen, but for crying out loud, do not get too close when this stuff comes down. You got choices to make. And the choices, literally, regardless of where the pendulum is, ultimately haven't changed. The choice is still about choosing life. Now, sometimes, right, if the train is coming down the tracks, choosing life means move. Get out of the way. And sometimes, if there are several trains coming down different tracks, then the choice of which direction to move becomes more important. And in all cases, part of choosing life, in other words, involves listening to him. Back to Korah and to this issue that he raised about how he saw leadership and power a bit differently than Moshe did. He certainly didn't see it as servant leadership. He saw it as, I want to be above. I want to be the man at the top. Man with the plan. I want to be the big boss that capo de tutte capos. You know, we got so many hundreds of phrases in different languages, I guess you could use to point out that same singular human lust for power. And it's the opposite of what Torah talks about. It's the opposite of what we see in Moshe. It's almost a sacrificial form of human leadership. It's the same thing, by the way, that we see in a house, where it's the way that a husband is supposed to cover his wife, to love, to take care of his house. Same concept of servant leadership. I think part of the reason why we get so much trouble in marriage is because, just like as in other places, we see that it's, the husband is over the wife. I had a counseling session. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but years ago with a fellow that I was trying to get through to, having marital problems, and he kept saying, well, yeah, but the wife is below the husband. The husband is above the wife. I said, no, as long as you've got that attitude in mind, regardless of what you're reading, you got the wrong attitude here. Now, there are times, and I can speak as a pilot, right, where as pilot in command of an airplane, if there was an emergency to come up, and I say to somebody, open the door. I don't want an answer. I don't want to give them an explanation. The point is, when there is a true situation where life and death hangs in the balance, somebody needs to say, do this, do it now. I don't have time to answer why. But that's not the same thing as saying to be above someone. I'm saying this because I'm going to lord it over. No, I'm saying this because I care about our lives. Period. The difference may not look to somebody that's watching from outside all that big. Well, in one case, somebody gave an order and somebody else said, yes, sir. And in another case, somebody gave an order, ha, 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 because I'm above you. Maybe because I've got power, because I've got a gun, and I can kill you if you don't do it. Big difference. In one case, you can still have the same situation. The article here points out there are several places where you can see examples of leadership that doesn't necessarily involve command. The one that I liked was an orchestra. It has a conductor. It's not that the conductor of the orchestra is going to shoot somebody or do evil to them, but he's there so that the orchestra will play in unison. You can watch and you can see. And, the first violin is every bit as important. And some of these other positions, all of these things are important. But the leader is there to lead, not to command necessarily. Back to Moshe, back to the difference between him and Korah. In a social order, different from the one that the people of the world outside of the Torah understand, everyone has equal dignity in the eyes of the law, right? There'll be one Torah, one law, one instruction for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Even though they're a stranger in the land, same instruction, same law applies. The leader doesn't stand above the people. He serves the people. Why? Because he serves Elohim. And if you go back and look at some stuff we talked about very recently, Moshe was the most anav dude on the planet. Humble, meek, teachable. But he didn't stand above the people. He was a humble man, more humble than anyone else. This is the essence of servant leadership. And it's what the Torah talks about. And of course, again, it's what Yeshua talked about. One other interesting thing. Now, we're going to talk about some differences and offices, if you will, in Scripture. There's only one person in the Torah, says this same article by Rabbi Sachs, that is commanded to be humble. Now, I've talked about this particular passage before, but this is an interesting way to phrase it, and it picks out something which is really interesting from here and makes it key. Some of you know that in order to be king over Israel, the king was commanded to write himself a copy of the Torah. Now, most of the time, I don't really care, at this point, because we got no kings that even bother to read the thing that they took an oath on a Bible to, the Constitution in so many cases. But I think we'd be better off if they did this, whether it was the entire Torah, at least then we'd have less applicants, or just the book of Deuteronomy. They were supposed to write a copy of this Torah on the scroll, and it was to, and I'm quoting from Deuteronomy 17, chapter 17, verses 18 through 20. This scroll was to be with him, the king. He is to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, follow carefully all the words of this Torah and these decrees, these statutes and judgments and commandments, and he is not to consider himself better above his fellow Israelites. Can you see how much that is utterly repugnant to leadership today? Ask the King of the United States why it is you get to fly in an airplane while you're telling other people they can't even have airplanes. If we get a chance, we'll do stories like that. Why it is that you can have all kinds of armed troops, but none of the peons out there are allowed to have even small arms. Why it is you get to go play golf and, you know, you pick it, folks. The imperial dictatorship in the United States really isn't anything new. But to tell the president, all rise, or the judge, or any number of others, you're not above those peons that you rule over, you haughty you-know-what you? Why do you think I took this job? It's not just the money, it's the power. There's a quote from C.S. Lewis in here that I like too. C.S. Lewis rightly defined humility as not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. The essence of great leadership, I've already mentioned a couple of examples, is that they respect others. They honor them, they lift them, they inspire them to reach heights that they wouldn't have done otherwise. I mean, they called Reagan the great communicator. Obviously, there were some problems, and that's a whole nother story. But there's a certain difference, at least, because you do get the impression that the guy had a certain desire to see people do well. Probably, like so many, wouldn't have run for office if he didn't have an ego. But nevertheless, there are leaders. We can look at them in history, at least, even if we can't find hardly any that are still alive today, that do not succumb to the arrogance of power. Korah was ambitious, no question. All right, that's kind of part A of the situation. I guess what I want to do here is we'll talk a little bit about that, then I'm going to come back, talk about the other aspects of Moses' style of leadership and the things that really apply to us today. And I'll tell them what I'm going to tell them. There's an aspect that we've already talked about, which is power. Right? All political power, all power, said Mao, period, flows from the barrel of a gun. Power to print money is an incredible power. One of the most awesome. Love of money is the root of all evil. You can see similar things. We'll talk about that in the news here as well. But in one sense, we have power, and one of the things that people sometimes fail to do is to make one other distinction. Yeah, there's hubris, there's this desire for a lust for power to rule over others, and sometimes people confuse power with influence. People can have influence even if they're powerless. Think about that for a second. We'll come back, we'll fill in those gaps, but I first want to talk about power and the application of power and some of the things that are going on now this week that'll help to make that clear. Here's a piece, this actually came out Monday, from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, Insider. And I often quote Roberts because, as an insider, he has a certain amount of gravitas, if you will. And also because I find it really interesting that here's a fellow who was close to the central seat of power and is now, having come out of her. Maybe I still don't agree with everything that he says. He certainly has access to a lot of information and connections. But nevertheless, he's telling it like it is more and more. And you can certainly see, if you look over his work in the last couple of years, kind of a metamorphosis as he's moved more and more outside and embraced more and more things that once upon a time would have been called conspiracy theories as fact. So here's another one of those. The citizens of the United States, he wrote earlier this week, still don't know why their government destroyed Iraq. That's quite a statement, isn't it? The reason? National security. They'll never know. It's the cloak behind which the U.S. government hides its crimes. George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush the Elder, former director of CIA, he says, who became president courtesy of being picked or mandated as Ronald Reagan's VP, was the last restrained U.S. president. When the first Bush attacked Iraq, it was a limited operation with the alleged goal to evict Saddam Hussein, by the way, who was a former good big buddy insider with George Herbert Walker Bush. Kuwait, he notes, was once even a part of Iraq. But new boundaries were created. By the way, those boundaries are being rewritten today. I'm going to skip over a bunch of the history, because what he describes is a lot of the lead-up to the first Iraq war, and having to do with the border and the fact that Kuwait, this politically created subdivision, people were drilling back and forth across the border. And he makes some interesting comments. Here's the key to all of this. Back in those days, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, John Kelly, and others, testified that, quote, the United States has no commitment to defend Kuwait, no intention of defending Kuwait if it's attacked by Iraq. Turns out that was a whopper, because they did it anyway. In other words, among other things, what he's saying here is that kind of the history of this relationship is cloaked in duplicity and lies and changing alliances and all kinds of stuff. I'm gonna be real blunt. I do believe that there is a force for evil, the adversary, and I do think there are whole lots of princes and kingdoms on this world that know who they serve. Sometimes they don't know who they serve, but they serve him anyway. And they're, if you want to call him Ha-Satan or Lucifer or the bad guy or Old Scratch, I don't have a problem with the names. Molech, Beelzebub. But there's no question that there's a whole lot of influence in the world that is coordinated, literally coordinated. Looks like there's, battles all over the place, but ultimately they're serving a singular purpose. Now, the creator of the universe to allow us this to happen, because he's warned us that these things were going to happen. He used all kinds of what we would call evil empires in the past, from Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar on down the line to Rome, and later even others that are politically incorrect to talk about and still are. Back to Roberts here. He's testified that the U.S. at least July 31st, just 2 days before the Iraqi invasion, said, we have no intention to defend Kuwait. And 2 days later, well, we lied. From 2003 back until 1990, I did that in the opposite direction, from 1990 till 2003, Iraq was acceptable to the U.S. government. And in 2003, it became unacceptable. We don't know why. We're told it's because Saddam Hussein had WMDs. They're trotting out that old lie again today. And now all of a sudden there's a threat. It's Al-Qaeda. Turns out Al-Qaeda was trained and has lots and lots of connections to U.S. intelligence and many other kinds of things. Hey, again, it's tough to know who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. Maybe the answer is because if they're all serving the same master, what difference does it make? The Iraqi threat remains a mystery for Americans. Now, I'm going to cut to the chase here. Let's cut to the end of Dr. Roberts' commentary. He says the consequences of Washington's destruction of Saddam's secular government has been ongoing. Years of violence, a lot worse than the earlier U.S. occupation of Iraq. Does anybody remember all the propaganda? Washington had to overthrow that dictator, Saddam Hussein, in order to bring freedom and democracy and women's rights to Iraq. Yes, it's about defending freedom. They got to be taken over there before they come over here. Do you remember, too, the promises of a cakewalk war? Only going to be a few weeks, and oh, by the way, it'll make oil prices cheap. Got a story just this week from, an analyst for 5-Minute Forecast saying, yeah, that sure worked out well, didn't it? What's the situation this week? Well, we know that Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, has been overrun by who? Al-Qaeda, ISIS. Hey, what difference does it make, right? Ultimately, they're serving the moon god. These are the forces that Washington claims have been utterly defeated any number of times. Now they control the second largest city and a number of provinces. And the person that Washington said was their puppet or their man in Iraq is no longer the man in Iraq. This week, the United States said he's got to go. So what happened? The other would-be dictator of the world, Putin, says, well, then we'll take him. We'll support him, al-Maliki. Here's Robert's summary. You'll see where I'm headed in a second. These defeated forces, he said, ha ha, now control Iraq's second largest city, number of provinces. Person that Washington left in charge is now begging for military help against the jihadist forces that incompetent Washington regimes, plural, but basically it's the same regime, whether it's got a Bush in command or a Clinton in command or an Obama in command, have unleashed in the Muslim world. Now listen to this. What Washington has done, he says, in Iraq and Libya, and is trying to do in Syria, would have done, except for the American people were not quite gullible enough then to go along with it, is to destroy, this is the way that the some of the insiders are putting it, to destroy the governments that kept the jihadists under control. Washington faces the prospect of a jihadist government encompassing Syria and Iraq. And the neocon conquest of the Middle East is now becoming an Al-Qaeda conquest or an ISIS conquest. What's being done, folks? I'll put it in the way that they're putting it. Turns out if you hear terms like ISIS or ISIL, I won't do this story either, but I saw an interesting piece. Well, I might do it. I'll mention just a couple of lines from it. This is from Claude Salani, and I saw it on oilprice.com and Zero Hedge. Why ISIS won't stop with Iraq. The thing that is called ISIS or ISIL stands for, and it's because part of the problem is there's a translation issue. Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant is a serious threat to the region. Now, you already know probably that it was, in fact, trained in Jordan, as it turns out, by U.S. forces, that there were all these arms that were left behind, and they got all of those good U.S. taxpayer-paid arms, all the better to take over with. And the unexpected and stunning victories are worrisome. At least that's the story in Washington. But the problem is this. If you understand this word, ISIL, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and what they are referring to, the Arabic word, Syria or Levant, in no case is the word that's really used there. He says the real word where they get the acronym ISIS from is the Islamic State of Sham. And the closest translation into English is Greater Syria. So this is the Islamic State of Greater Syria. And that word may fool folks, he says, in the West. They may fail to see the real dimensions here because they think of Syria in the modern sense. They go look at a map and they say, where's Syria? But you know what? Just as modern Israel has boundaries that are not the same as the biblical Israel, lots smaller than biblical Israel. I guess the same thing goes for the Muslim world. And that word in Arabic for greater Syria is Suria. And when they refer to Al-Sham or Az-Sham, he says you got to realize they're referring to greater Syria, which is not like current Syria. Current Syria is bordered by Turkey on the one side to the north, Iraq to the east, there you go, Jordan and Israel to the south, and Lebanon to the west. But greater Syria, basically, includes pretty much all of the above. So when they say Az-Sham, they're talking about greater Syria. And another way to think of it, in other words, is the Islamic Caliphate. And what we're really saying here, and what Paul Craig Roberts is saying, but not in those terms, is what is being done is Washington is literally stepping back. And whether they're doing it actively, whether everybody knows what's going on or not, what's being allowed to happen is the recreation of an Islamic caliphate. Interesting point. Media blackout of Iraqi war dead is a striking double standard, says another piece, aimed at shielding Obama. Whether the president's going to go in and support the troops, the Shiites there or not, you know, there's a lot of inside baseball here. But ultimately, what's kind of undeniable is all of the supposed good that the neocons were talking about, from oil that's cheap to stabilizing the Mideast, has turned out to be a great big whopping lie. We got lots and lots of upset people who are saying, wait a minute, my son, my husband, myself went and fought in these wars. Some gave their lives. For what? So that a bunch of absolute nutcases could go out beheading people, taking the arms that we so stupidly left behind, and using those? something's horribly wrong here. One last set of stories, then we'll get back to the concept, power versus influence, that I want to tackle next. If there's a single story to my mind, I'm going to, every time I read through this story, talked about it yesterday with Jeff on Drive Time Friday, I talked about it last night. I'll admit, when I look at stories lately that just really, 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 really bug me, it's stuff like this. Now, the good news here is, because we're going to talk about influence, I think there's a desire on all of our parts to be able to have influence. It may not be the same as power. But certainly, you know, the question that I return to frequently is, hey, we got loved ones, right? Go home for Thanksgiving, and we're sitting around the table, and the question comes about religion or politics or economics. Take your pick. And, you know, I'm seen as the black sheep of the family. They don't listen, whatever. Well, more and more and more of these contradictions, I think, are at least causing a few people who wouldn't listen, say, a week ago or a month ago or a year ago, to step back and say, wow, they're telling me one thing, and what I'm seeing is the exact opposite, whether it's in the Mideast or whether it's in the grocery store. How can I reconcile these lies? Want to influence people? Be able to give an account for what you believe and why, and point out how it is consistent with Scripture. So that's a big part of the goal here today. And it's part of why I say, okay, when I see these contradictions, they really, really, I'll say it politely as I can, torque me off. Here's one of them. This is from a piece that I saw it on Kurt Nimmo. It's a nice summary. I'd been thinking about certain aspects of this, but this kind of helps me to put it in the proper perspective. The corporate media, he says, is taking its cues from the CFR policy tool. It's called Foreign Policy Magazine. It was formerly owned by the misnamed Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And, of course, now, like I said, it's the mouthpiece of the one of the biggest conspiracy groups around, the CFR. And they had their spokesperson, or at least one of them, a fellow named David Gartenson Ross. He's supposedly a terrorism analyst and a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Whoa, democracies, how noble. He's an expert on ISIS and all the other Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And he said the following. Listen to this and ask yourself, can you say this with a straight face? He said the U.S. intelligence just had no idea that the ISIS group was about to mount a major offensive and take over two major cities in Iraq simultaneously. He says this isn't going to look good for the Obama administration and might play into the hands of the critics, too. In other words, the fact that we were utterly, utterly, utterly wrong about this, and we were supposedly completely caught off guard, look really stupid, or something, that might strengthen the hands of the critics. Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, said she too had no idea. She was clueless. She didn't quite come out and say it that bluntly, but she said the following. Oh, by the way, at a Council on Foreign Relations shindig, she said, quote, "The extent to which ISIS could be effective in seizing cities in Iraq and trying to erase boundaries to create this caliphate, was a shock to her. She was completely unaware of that." Now, there's a couple things about this that, as you can suggest, suspect, really irritate me. A, what the heck are we paying these people for? Well, if it's not just a lust for power, obviously. I mean, let's be real. No, what's the claim? Well, in the interest of national security, you need to trade essential liberty for a little temporary security. Trade your birthright for a cup of pottage. They put their hand on the Bible and they swore that they're going to preserve and protect a constitution that says you have certain God-given rights that are protected, not granted, by that document. Freedom of speech, assembly, worship, to petition the government for redress of grievances, to keep and bear arms, to be free of illegal search and seizure. Oh, hardly! No, in the name of national security, Big Brother listens, watches, gropes, x-rays, and microwaves you. Takes away your guns, takes away your privacy, will not allow you to dissent. Even got drones now. Gonna break up people on the streets, fire tear gas grenades or worse at them. because the peons don't have any of those rights. Why? Well, because we're so concerned about your safety. It's all about national security. That's why we tap every phone in the world and why we listen to every computer that we feel like. It's why we record trillions of phone calls and text messages and emails. That's why we know all and see all. And what? You were utterly ignorant that ISIS, these people that you've been training and giving arms to and arming in Syria, you were utterly ignorant of what they were planning on doing. Well, pardon my bluntness. What the hell good is your listening and watching and monitoring and groping if you're absolutely clueless when it comes to the things that supposedly you're supposed to be doing? Or is there just some big whopper of a lie in place here that it doesn't have anything to do with servant leadership at all? It has to do with the pure, unadulterated lust for power. Power. Power as an end unto itself. The lust for power, because I want to be above you, you peon. That's why we disarm you. That's why we take your stuff. That's why your 401k is a 101k now. And that's why we're fixing to take the rest. That's why we need to disarm you, so that when you realize you've been lied to and you're powerless, you won't be able to fight back. It's because, well, we've taken your children, we've taken your God, we've taken your guns, we've taken your gold, we've taken everything we can, and we want your bodies too. You're a human resource, after all. Haven't we been telling you that for years? The bottom line of this piece says, Kurt Nimmo is, well, these same folks are fixing to dupe the American people one more time. Tell them, see, ISIS is really a bad guy. That's why you, because of our incompetence, have to give us even more power so that maybe we'll get it right this time. Yeah, you buying that yet? Well, don't worry. They're going to mount an effective PR campaign to try to sell that to the American people. But the other thing that bugs me about this, of course, is, well, the real excuse, even though you're not going to hear it from the waystream media, is the reason why we were totally caught unaware of the real terrorists in the world. You know, those folks that are taking their AK-47s that we left behind for them, and their Stinger missiles that we left behind, and their MRAPs, well, the ones we didn't send off to, you know, little townships in the U.S. to suppress you when the time comes. We left those behind. They got all kinds of good stuff. They're even shipping the excess, says one other story, to Syria and to the other borders of the Islamic Caliphate so that they can continue their push outward. Thank you very much, U.S. taxpayer. We appreciate your largesse. Why were we caught off guard? Well, because the real terrorists, says Dirty Harry Reid, and the White House, and the Congress, and the Republican so-called opposition in the Congress too, by the way. Well, the real terrorists are those people that have a Bible and that think that they still have God-given rights, and that the Constitution ought to apply. Those are the ones we're really concerned about. Those are the ones we're really paying attention to your emails and phone calls. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We could care less that, Al-Rashid is talking to Al-whatever-else and Mohammed Al-Bamo and planning on killing a few folks. No, it's the United States where we want to take your houses and your ranches and your water and your guns. We ignored the real terrorists so that we could focus on the domestic terrorists that we perceive as the only threat to us, the Washington terrorists. And at the same time, the ISIS folks are running amok in Iraq. The UN is pushing their program of action to track and destroy and confiscate small arms in the United States. Everywhere else, too, but they're going to focus on the United States because that's where most of the peons got them. Obama's already said he wants to pull an Australian kind of thing here, and what they did in Australia, of course, is stole them all. They claimed it was voluntary. By being here, you volunteered. We'll mention one other story that I think really kind of fits. Some of you have heard about Lois Lerner, IRS. This, to my mind, is it's a major distraction. It was enough to get Tricky Dick Nixon nearly impeached. He had the missing 18 minutes of tapes. I mean, look at that, 18 minutes of tapes, trivial by comparison. He was accused of a teeny little break-in getting some G2 on the political opponents. I mean, that's nothing compared to the NSA tapping all your phones. Of course, they were working on it back then, too, but they hadn't gotten it in place yet, like it's been done since then. And he was alleged to have, you know, used the IRS a bit. And so he had at least the good sense to resign when he was caught. Yep, you caught me. I'm not a crook. I guess I'll resign. Well, today we got Lois Lerner, the head of the House, or the IRS, well, scandal, among other things, that is charged with manipulating the 501c3 Caesar-created state-chartered churches and tax-deductible organizations to persecute those that aren't towing the Big Brother government line. I will suggest that the problem, of course, is that people that are really serving Yah shouldn't be asking for permission from another god anyway. But nevertheless, there are folks that are upset about this. And the funny thing is the following. Here's the news this week. This has been going on for months, and there has been stonewalling, and there has been destruction of evidence, and there's been stuff that would have been called fraud and perjury and high crimes and misdemeanors and all kinds of other stuff. But, of course, given that the world is falling apart and we've got trillions of dollars to steal, that's not nearly as big of a deal. The news this week was, the dog ate my homework, right? Lerner's computer and all of her emails, shazam! That just disappeared! Now, we're a federal agency supposed to have all kinds of record-keeping and taxpayer-paid computer backups of everything, and NSA is watching, and of course we have every kind of computer safeguard and stuff in place. But somehow or other, every single one of her emails, not just those, but in particular, certain emails, ones that went to the Department of Just Us, and the White House, and the Treasury, and, in other words, any place outside the IRS where there would have been links to other power centers, just disappeared. Congressman Daryl Issa on this House Oversight and Government Reform Committee says, official records, like the emails of a prominent official, don't just disappear without a trace unless that was the intention, unquote, and gee, give me a break. Now, here's the funny part, and I'm going to connect this, of course, with the same. Are they truly incompetent, or are they just lying, power-mongering terrorists masquerading as public servants? Let's see which one makes the more sense here. It hasn't been pointed out by the waste stream. I've mentioned it. This fellow, Max Slavo, SHTF plan, has mentioned it. Just about all kinds of other peoples are pointing out the obvious, except for CNN, ABC, CBS, and the three-letter propaganda agencies. Where's the NSA? Aren't they knowing all, seeing all, hearing all, tapping all? Don't they have, get this, they have the ability at the Utah data center, paid for, of course, by newly printed U.S. tax dollars, a facility capable of holding 1 septillion pages of information. They have records of 20 trillion, this is admitted, domestic phone calls, and many times that more in the way of text messages and emails. They got Lerner's emails, let's not kid ourselves. They got your emails. They got your text message about picking up the kids at the soccer game. And they can't come up with these? Who's kidding who? What good is Big Brother watching and listening if he can't stop terror, and he can't even stop high crimes and misdemeanors, and the kind of things that got presidents impeached, or at least kicked out of office, back when we had a rule of law? And then I'll ask one more question, too. If, after a lot of discussion, if they were finally to pony up some emails, would you believe them? Guess what? The email showed that she didn't talk to anybody. We got them all. Perfectly innocent. Yeah, sure. If they can target your emails, listen to your computer that you thought was off, do you think they can backdate an email and change the text? I mean, give me a break. Let's pause for a second. By the way, any questions or comments? Did I miss anything? Okay, I don't think I see anything. If there's any from the other room, we'll try to get those popped across too. Let's go back to this question of Moses, his leadership style, versus what Korah would have been, you know, the lust for power, the desire to be above, and so forth. There's another aspect to this, too. Now, this is a little bit more esoteric. And it looks like, according to the Torah, and this is the way that it's another article on the same subject anyway by Jonathan Sacks, describing the fact that maybe even Joshua didn't quite understand it at one point. We talked about this here a week or so ago. There were two men. These were the two that may not have been picked to serve on the set of elders. Remember, there were 72. If you multiplied six men from each of the tribe, that's 72. But they were only going to have 70 elders. So there were two that presumably volunteered out, Eldad and Medad. And they ended up prophesying. And so when they're prophesying out there, here comes Joshua, tell Moshe about it, and say, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And Moses and the 70 elders weren't aware of it. And Joshua thought this might be a threat to Moses' leadership. Now, wait a second. Aren't we talking about a threat to his leadership with Korah, with his rebellion? So what's the difference? Why aren't Eldad and Medad seen as threats? Joshua seemed to think they might be. So he came and he said, Moses, hey, stop them. Are you jealous for my sake? Moshe told him. Would that all the people of Yahuwah were prophets, and that that Yahuwah Elohim would put his spirit on them. Something is very different. Moses doesn't see these two people out prophesying as a threat at all. Joshua doesn't quite understand the difference at this point. So why are they not a threat, but Korah is? Is Moses being inconsistent? So let's go back and look in Bamidbar, Numbers. There's this very book where Moses asks Elohim to choose the next leader of the Israelites. And he tells him, we already know this, go get Joshua, appoint him as a successor. And I think this is a very interesting set of instructions that he's given. Yahuwah says to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man of spirit. We've heard that reference before, too. And lay your hand on him. Make him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly. Commission him in their presence and give him some of your splendor. Now, there's a little bit of Midrash that goes with this. Let's see what we can say for sure. Moses is commanded to do several things. In particular, not just the obvious, take him and do this in the presence of all of Israel, but perform two specific acts as he presents Joshua, his successor, to the priests and to the people that he is going to, rule over. Rule. Let's get rid of the word over or above. Rule. Coordinate. And serve. He's to be another servant leader. The first thing is he's to lay his hand on Joshua. He's doing this in the sight of the people. And the next thing is to, quote, give him some of your splendor. So what does all that mean? And basically they say, well, what the sages have said over the years is that lay your hand on him is a little bit like what happens when you light a candle or light a menorah. You lay your hand on it, and the light, the flame, passes from one to the other. But here's the key. Is the flame diminished? No, the one candle lights the other. When you're done, you got two candles, not one. Twice as much light. First candle does not sacrifice itself to give light to the second, or to light it off. On the other hand, when it says, give him some of your splendor, what they say is, this is a little bit like pouring out water or oil from one vessel to another. Now, when you pour water out of a glass and out of a pitcher into a glass, the pitcher has less water, the glass has more. This is what they call a zero-sum game. Lighting a candle multiplies the light. Pouring water or oil splits. And here you go. Now we've got this essence of this difference between power and influence. Don't confuse them. And, of course, the essence of true leadership is to understand, to distinguish and properly use both when both are available. And it boils down to this. When you are talking about power, it's literally like pouring water out of a pitcher. The more you share, the less you have. But when it comes to influence, like lighting a candle, the more that is shared, the more light, the more influence there is. And you can see that, right? You go out and influence a person. When you tell somebody at the dinner table and they listen and you influence them, they can go tell others. You can literally see an idea spread like wildfire from time to time. Now, the key, of course, is the other aspect of what we're talking about here is to do it in accord with what Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh would have us do. When you're spreading influence in His name and doing it in the way that He tells you to, it's an incredibly powerful thing. And, of course, in the Torah, as this story points out, there really are two different leadership roles that kind of exemplify those things. The first one is king. King has power. They can levy taxes. They can conscript people. Well, we just read it at the start of this discussion today in Samuel. King's going to do all of these things. King literally has, in a lot of cases, absolute power. He has the power of life and death. He can order people killed. On the other hand, the other office that had influence, but not so much power, was the office of prophet. Matter of fact, a lot of prophets didn't have any power at all. I love the stories about Elijah. Here's a guy without power that nevertheless walks in to Ahab's throne room. He's tended to tick off Ahab in the past. This is what we would call an act with chutzpah. He doesn't have power, but he's exercising influence. These prophets had lots of influence, and a lot of times it wasn't even really made known until after they were dead. They certainly didn't have power to enforce things. You can look at Elijah's fight against corruption, Amos's call for social justice, Isaiah's visions, and all of these things are still very much apropos today. They still influence us thousands of years later. On the other hand, compare that to an Ahab or a Jehoshaphat or a Jehu. When they're dead, they're dead. Their power ends. The prophet still has influence long after his death. And the key about Moshe is he was a true leader, servant leader, and he had both kinds of roles. He was a prophet, and he was also a leader. He wasn't a king, per se, but he certainly commanded armies, and he directed the people of Israel. He had power, and he was a prophet. And that's why he, in fact, did the same thing with Joshua. He gives him this double investiture. He is told to give him his authority as a prophet by laying his hand on him. And, by the way, that's the exact same phrase that's used elsewhere. It's the same phrase that this rabbi points out. They still use in rabbinic ordinations. Semicha, meaning the laying on of hands by a master to his disciple. And secondly, he was giving Joshua the power of kingship, his splendor. So he had this multiple head role, head of state, director of the tribes, and commander of the army. And Joshua, too. We see some prophetic aspects to the things that he did. The key here is, if we look back at Korah, he made a couple of mistakes. One, he was looking for power only and for the wrong reasons. He wanted to be over. And two, like many, many others, he made this mistake, didn't distinguish between power and influence. And as we look at the world today and we see what's going on, I think we got the same situation happening. We have a whole bunch of people in positions of power, if you will, not necessarily leadership, and that's part of the reason why sometimes when I'll pray, I'll distinguish those two things. Pray for the people in power, even if they're not necessarily our leaders. And if the world doesn't understand the distinction, the world's got a whole heap of trouble coming. Part of the whole concept, again, now to kind of go full circle, of coming out of her is to understand that the intention of power in most of the world, certainly that power that serves the prince of this world in whatever form, is to make sure that the people, particularly those that it doesn't like because they serve another Elohim, are powerless. They're going to lie. They're going to cheat. They're going to steal. They're going to kill. They're going to destroy if they can. They are destroying things all around the world. They are arming the worst terrorists you can imagine and attempting to disarm those that they call terrorists who, in fact, simply serve another god and don't recognize their authority. For the time being, yeah, we do have power. Ultimately, we have the most important power in the universe on our side, if, in fact, we are serving him. And that's the key. That was the thing that Moses pointed out to Korach. Let's just see who is serving him. Of course, part of the distinction, too, I mentioned Eldad, Medad, and Joshua's confusion, and the situation with Korah, his rebellion. Big difference. Because Korah wanted absolute power. He wanted to be the replacement Moshe. Can't share power with a Korah. He wants to be above. And there's only one above, and the rest is all below. Moshe recognized this. Ultimately, Korah backed him, Moshe, and he, Korah himself, into a corner. There can be only one. It's a line from a movie, if you remember it. The only one wasn't going to end up being Korah. Ultimately, there's only one, too. True master of the universe. He's Echad. Who is serving him? Well, if we want to be on the right team, we better make sure we're serving him first. And if we want to influence people, then we need to have access to information. We need to rightly divide the word. We need to be like the Bereans, search out the scripture for ourselves. The one thing that we know that's true, we may not be able to tell who the good guys and the bad guys are between the Shiites and the Sunnis. Maybe there aren't any because maybe they're all serving another master. But we can tell what's true. At least once we begin to recognize the consistent pattern, right? Line by line, precept by precept. You start with the rock, and you build on that, and you understand the real simple concepts that all these other things are built on. Choose life. Choose whom you will serve. Make sure you're serving the right master. When you are allowed to be, if you are placed in a position of leadership, it needs to be servant leadership. But we all, whether we are in a position of leadership or not, can exercise at least aspects of that role of the prophet by way of influence. Even if the worst comes to pass and people are utterly made powerless, you can still have influence. And of course, as long as you're serving the right master, truly, and are made in his image and recognize that, well, there's no power outside of him that can prevail. We have some very good promises in that regard. Doesn't necessarily mean we know how it's all going to work out. So back to where we go with this, and I guess I'll start to wrap it up with this too. The singular message, come out of her, my people, I think it's clear and it remains. You look at the news today and you see, wow, I mean, the contradictions, the lies. If you can't talk to people about the big whopper of, NSA, you traded a little essential liberty for security, traded your birthright for a cup of pottage, you got all these people in positions of power that say they support the Constitution and say they've taken an oath before God, and by their actions, by their fruit, they're liars and the truth is not in them. It's as absolutely undeniable as the nose on your face. We got people that are listening to this, as I occasionally mention, whether they're at NSA or the FBI or any number of other places. I would encourage them to understand. You may think you're serving the power, but you're not. If you're on Korah's team, something worse than the earth opening up to swallow you alive may eventually happen. I'm not making a prophecy or a promise or anything else. I'm just saying, if you're not on the right team, you got to be asking yourself the question, what do I need to do today? Have I taken oaths that I'm dishonoring? Am I serving the wrong God? For crying out loud. There's no time like the present to repent, to teshuva, turn around, and get right with him. And then start doing the right thing. Find out what it is that he would have you do. That's the kind of influence that we can have. Even if we're powerless, essentially, to go in and demand because of our vote, or any number of other ruses that people have been led to believe really matter, you can still have the kind of influence that says, study, show yourself approved, be able to give an answer when you're asked, why do you believe what you believe? Can you take people through? His Word? Can you show them these things that really matter? These are matters of life and death. And a servant leader ought to be able to explain those things. So that's the real key. When people ask us, why aren't you participating? Why aren't you voting? Why aren't you using, credit cards or fake dollars or whatever it may be that the world says you've got to have? Why aren't you paying attention to the World Cup? Isn't that the most important thing? What was the other big ruse this week? Oh, Dirty Harry, some football team, for crying out loud. The Redskins. This is the most important issue. I mean, give me a break. Terrorists are running the railroad, and we got idiots serving that other master, telling people the most important thing is the name of some stupid sports team. What kind of fools are out there? Can't we exert a little influence against in-your-face? I don't like to call people stupid, stiff-necked. But, you know, you read the stuff, you see what's going on in this story. Right after seeing what happened to Korah and those other men, what do these people do? Oh, you've killed the servants of the Lord. The hell you have. Separate yourself. There's a plague fixing to come. And the same thing is true today. He's promised the plagues. They'll get seven times worse and seven times worse and seven times worse. All right, you've heard almost all of that before. We're seeing it. I can't imagine, but we're going to see it play out. I was going to say, almost every week for a long, long time now, I kept saying, look, it's amazing. How much more in your face can it get? How much more in your face can it get? Well, it was pretty in your face when people started getting on trains in Germany, wasn't it? How do you know that's not happening now? Seriously, how would you know? You think you'd be told about it? You think the people who were caught blindsided, or maybe they weren't, by what happened in Iraq are being straight with people? You think when we're talking literally the ability to print money out of nothing and to buy the world's economies up? I didn't even do this story about the $29 trillion of dollars that the central banks have used to pump up the world's stock markets. We'll do that quickly. Turns out that if you add all the stock markets in the world together, the total value of every stock in every exchange, the DAX, the FTSE, the Japanese market, the Shanghai market, the New York, the S&P 500, the Dow, all of them, $62 trillion. The world's central banks have printed and pumped $29 trillion into that, and in the process, they literally have the ability to have bought nearly half of all stocks and all publicly traded companies in the world. Talk about power. They can sell. They can, at the punch of a button, they can collapse those stock markets and they can buy the rest. Right? Just got to print up a few trillion extra. This kind of stuff, when you're talking about the ability to take over the world with newly printed money and to keep that ruse going, and to lie to people in the process, do you think killing a few hundred or a few tens of millions or even a few billions in order to keep the gravy train going, if in fact all you really want anyway is the lust for power and the ability to be over people, and they're nothing but human resources beside, depreciate them to zero and kill them? And matter of fact, you know what? Was Stalin quoting Lenin? Anyway, famous other dictators in the past, Lenin called the people useful idiots. It was Stalin that said, the death of one man is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic. We're talking about an attitude, not servant leadership. And it says basically what I want, that's what matters, to be on top. Can I use the trillions of dollars? Yeah, you betcha. Ultimately, I'm headed to this again, folks. As Heinlein said, there's two kinds of people in the world. Those who have a lust for power to rule over others, to control them. Hey, Tricky Dick said it long after he was out of office. He was asked, would you rather have power or money? He said, well, power, of course. Because with power, I can get all the money I need. And, of course, if you've got money and power, I can get all the women I need. I can get all the food I need. I can get all the anything I ever want to satisfy any desire I might have that I might need. You got Kurzweil and people like that saying, with enough money, I can live forever. I can be like God. I can implant my consciousness in computers. I can modify human DNA. I can steal people's life force. I can modify and make better the human being. Hey, with unlimited power and money, I can be like Elohim in every way that matters. This is the kind of lust we're talking about. Why do I mention the humanity dividing itself into two camps? I'm going to go one step out here on a limb, folks. I'm going to suggest to you that as we begin to move into these positions of leadership, as we encounter others who are looking to come out, as we begin to build our camps prior to this regathering, as we hopefully are guided by Elohim in the process, we're going to encounter both kinds of humans. Those who desire to rule over, and to lord it over, to lust for power over others, and those who have no such desire. And I'm going to suggest to you up front that the first of those do not belong in the camp, period. I guess I'll say that again. Those who desire to have a lust for power over others until they can repent and truly be changed, and I'm not sure if that's possible. Yahuwah knows I don't. They got no business in our camps because they'll be the Korahs. And ultimately, that decision will come down to life or death. You can't have a Korah in the camp with a Moses. We got lots to learn as we begin this process of coming out, or as we continue it. And it starts with understanding the difference between power and influence, and being able to influence those that we love so that they can do the right thing and choose life. And then it continues towards, as we build our communities, making sure that that those who come out of her with us are called according to his purposes and are looking for the same things we're looking for, which is a return to his kingdom. And ultimately, it boils down to the same thing, right? If you've got people in the camp who are saying, well, better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, that attitude comes from one place. It's not going to fly in a camp or in a kingdom where we have to say there's one and only one Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and it's him and it's not me. Let's pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. And in fact, Abba, we know you are Echad. And you are our King, our Master, our Husband, we pray. We desire, Abba, to dwell in your house forever, to be a servant in your kingdom, to be a part of the camp that you're moving us into in your time and not ours. Father, we know there's a whole lot going on in the world, and it concerns us. We're concerned about our loved ones who don't seem to be walking the right path. We don't want them to die, Father. Help us to have influence from you, in accord with your word, and in a way that is pleasing to you. If we can't talk to some people, Father, send other witnesses to them. Touch their hearts, block their paths, put a wall around them, do whatever it takes. But help us to be instruments of your will and your word and your influence. Guide us in all that lies ahead. Help us to be counted worthy to escape the things we can see coming. Help us to be in the right place at the right time and to be walking the right path. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Deliver us from evil, from forces of the adversary, from deception, from all the things we can see. Fill us with your spirit. All this we ask in your name. Yahuwah Nisi, Yahuwah Zevaot. Hallelujah. Amen.